This is Lynn Benton Tractors Newsmakers, Wednesdays with Denise Quinn and Dave Bourne, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Live, local talk that matters to you. Now, here's Denise and Dave from the Capital Auto Group Studios, exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome to Hump Day Wednesday.
Hump Day.
It is Hump Day. We're on the downslide now to the weekend. Yes, that's what we are.
Yes, yes, yes. Tomorrow will be Friday Eve. I eagerly await Friday Eve.
Just start renaming Thursday.
Thursday has always been Friday Eve for me.
Nice. I like it. Well, had an interesting conversation last Wednesday with a couple of legislators.
With the Senators Bartsugar and Thatcher. That was a really great... I actually listened to that again. It was a lot of good information and packed into an hour for that show.
Podcast at kykn.com for all of our shows, by the way,
if you ever want
to check them out. And you can get a RSS feed, too, if you want that.
You can.
So today, you have arranged an interesting guest. Tell us who it is.
Our guest on the phone today is Derek LeBlanc. He's with the Kids Safe Foundation. So first of all, I want to welcome Derek to the show. Derek, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. I've been following your work for a long time. I'm a fan of your work. The work you do would warrant fans, but I appreciate what you do, especially, you know, in this sort of strange climate that we have to deal with in Oregon. So before, you know, I want to just kind of tell us a little bit about your foundation, who you are in it, what your role is, kind of just, you know, let us know who you are and what it is that you do with the Kids Safe Foundation.
Okay, my role is I'm the president and founder of the Kids Safe Foundation. We're a small nonprofit. We're based in Eugene. And so we teach firearm safety and accident prevention to kids.
Ah.
And so far this year, we reached about 7,300 kids in Oregon, Washington, Northern California, and taught them these life-saving skills.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. Hearing that. First of all, can you tell me, SAFE is an acronym. What does that stand for?
It stands for Safety Around Firearms Education.
Perfect. You know, and I love that the focus of this for you is children, and it is firearm safety and education. Can you give us, what is the overarching goal? Why did you start the foundation? What's your goal? And, you know, what do you hope to see come out of this foundation?
Okay, so I started this process about 5 years ago. I'm an NRA certified firearm instructor. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of self-defense training for parents and people that were new to firearms.
Uh-huh.
And so at that point, I realized that I was potentially exposing to their kids to an accident inside the home or a potential accident. So that's when I started looking at programs. And, you know, being from Eugene, I was concerned about, you know, the programs that are available, whether they'd be well-received. And so I started developing my own. So it was about 2 years of hard development. Now we've been a nonprofit for almost 4 years now.
Mm.
And so we reached about 16,000 kids and taught them what to do if they ever come across an unsecured firearm.
So how receptive are parents? Again, you said you're in Eugene, you're in one of the big, you know, the big blue dot cities, relatively liberal, progressive city. How have you, you know, when you started rolling this program out, how were you received by parents and just people in general in the area?
And for the most part, everybody's been really, really good because I see, you know, everything you see on our social media, you know, we're not, you know, this isn't political for us, mm-hmm. This is strictly safety.
Yeah.
And so I respect all parents, even if you don't like firearms, you know, education is critical for our kids. And, you know, we teach our kids to swim because we don't want them to drown.
Right.
And so that's kind of the concept that I use when it comes to our firearm safety program is I want every kid in the state of Oregon to know what not to do if they were to ever come across a firearm, because they're coming in contact in, you know, different situations, like at the park. Sometimes the gun's used in the commission of a crime and it's kind of thrown out and kids can come in contact there. Sometimes when kids go over for a sleepover, you know, if they don't have the proper education, that's where they're more susceptible to that accident.
And, you know, you always talk about knowledge is power. I mean, you know, being a parent myself, we taught our son at a young age to respect firearms, to, you know, to similar to what you're teaching as well. A lot of parents, though, sometimes you see they want to just pretend that it's not there and there's no education. But then you're leaving your children vulnerable if, like you said, they go over to a friend's house and there's a firearm that's left out or they find one. You know, what are your classes like? What are you teaching when you've got kids in a room? What does it look like?
So our classes are typically 1 hour long.
Uh-huh.
And so we start off, you know, I always start off with a Pledge of Allegiance. I love my country. I love my flag.
Nice.
And I also love teaching safety. So we start off with a Pledge of Allegiance. Normally, kids and parents are in the classroom together.
Oh, okay.
And so I bring in guns. Once I get to the portion where I'm actually handling guns, I show the kids, obviously how they work. I answer any kind of questions that they might have. I give them, good relevant information when it comes to our firearms. Because, our kids at a young age are getting information from their environment, which is either, YouTube, TV, video games. Video games is a huge problem with young minds. And so that's what we're trying to address. And then we also cover, accident prevention. And then we also cover anti-bullying as well, which, we've been credited with stopping 2 local school shootings, in the last 2 years because of kids that have been through our program.
Wow. So you mentioned video games. That's kind of been a hot button issue. I mean, again, every time there's an unfortunate, mm-hmm. horrible shooting, mass shootings that come up, a lot of times, a certain segment of people are first, they're going to go immediately blame the gun. Another mm-hmm. segment then goes to video games. Do you notice kids who come in who have a preconceived notion about guns and firearms based on their video game play?
Oh, it's a huge problem. So one thing to think about, our kids from 2 to 7, they engage with what's called magical thinking, where they don't have enough life experience or maturity, and they're getting their information from their environment, like I mentioned earlier, which is they're talking about, the video games, the YouTube, the friends, violent TV and movies, so that's what's kind of shaping the way they kind of perceive the world. And so I have kids that come in at 5 that are experts on the modern sporting rifle,
mm-hmm.
and all of these different weapon systems where, I have a problem because I talk about zombies in there. I ask them, what do they know? I kind of pull the crowd, and a lot of them think zombies are real. And so for me as an educator, I think that's a huge problem because that's how these kids are perceiving the world. And so that's what we're trying to do is obviously hold parents more accountable when it comes to that and give parents, and we're not teaching parents to reparent their kids, but we want to give the parents that might not think about how these violent video games are, affecting those young minds. We want to give them options.
Hey, Eric, Derek, do you find it a problem trying to inform them that you don't get a do-over in life?
Oh, yeah.
In like a video game?
For sure. Yeah, and that's the thing. We talk about, what's real reality and what's not reality. And it's amazing how, the young mind, they think what happens in that video games, because everything's so real now. Mm-hmm. We have, high-definition television.
Yeah.
We have surround sound speakers. So these kids at a young age are definitely having a problem deciphering what's real, what's fake. And it comes down to, we have to, as parents, we have to be responsible when it comes to, exposing our children to these violent video games, because they are altering their minds. There are statistics. I have statistical data that shows that it makes our kids more, violent at a young age. It makes them more aggressive. And so, the problem I'm having right with what's happening now is I'm glad that the president actually addressed video games, because that's kind of the first time it's ever been talked about in recent years when it comes to one of these shootings. And I'm not saying that this is the end all be all, but I think there's something that we should probably look into when it comes to these young minds and video games.
I think there's a lot of desensitization that goes on as well. And when you're kind of exposed to something over and over and over again, you get a little numb to it. Anytime they're fraught with, heat and passion. People on both sides of the issue care deeply and care passionately. We have different ways of maybe solving the problem. But I'm encouraged that, you have parents. Are you finding... What's the typical kind of parent who would bring their kid to you for this kind of training? Or is there a typical? Is there a typical?
It's pretty non-typical, actually. Yeah. I'm pretty lucky because of the way I word the message, because it's our program's for every kid. We've actually translated our curriculum in, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Mandarin, Japanese.
Excellent.
Because those kids do not have any access to education. And I want to have education for every kid in the state of Oregon or the country. I'm ready to go national. We're working on that right now as we speak. But our program's for every kid. Just like we're teaching our kids to wear bicycle helmets, I think it's, statistically, in the state of Oregon, firearms are definitely more deadly, and it's because of lack of education. And so that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to be on the forefront of that to make sure that we educate the kids and the families. And so about 42% of the parents that come to our classes do not have any firearms in their home. And so about 25% of the 42 that come, they actually follow us up on the range, and we actually get to shoot rimfires with the kids. So that's an extra option that we're able to reinforce good safety principles actually using rimfire rifles.
Oh, interesting. I bet that's a lot of fun. I want to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk to you about kind of a little bit about what an actual class was, rimfire, things like that. And then I know you've also been very active in the political world as far as legislation, and you were active in the 2019 mm-hmm. session. So I want to come back and talk to you more about that. We are talking to Derek LeBlanc, who is with Kids Safe Foundation. You're listening to Newsmakers Wednesdays with Denise on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers, Wednesdays with Denise and Dave, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Now let's go back to the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers is proudly brought to you by Green Acres Landscape.
Excellent. And we are back, and we're speaking with Derek LeBlanc from the Kids Safe Foundation, talking firearms, education, safety, zero accidents. Derek, before we left for our break, we were talking about kind of, you know, what a class looks like, and you have some classroom training for the kids and parents, but then you also have some practical. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like?
Yes, so the practical stuff that we do that about twice a month, and mm-hmm. one is at ARPC, which is about, you know, half hour south of where you guys are located now. But basically, we reinforce the skills that we learned in that first class, and we practice, and we get good repetitions on the range with rimfires.
Uh-huh.
And so typically that class, we get to shoot about 50 to 60, maybe 70 rounds per class.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's good repetitions for these kids. It takes 1,000 repetitions to create a good safe habit. That's so we're starting the foundation right there with good discipline and safety and respect for that firearm.
Excellent. I think that's so important. And I'm sure that has to, you know, the parents have to really, really like that as well. And that discipline. And again, like you're right, 1,000 times to get to enforce a habit. I follow you on social media, so I see a lot of the pictures, and it looks like everyone is having a great time. I mean, your classes are packed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so encouraged by what you're doing, because I think what you're doing is one of the keys to unlocking the issue, the problem, and moving forward, maybe working towards a solution. One of the things mm-hmm. we talked about earlier, too, is you have been involved legislatively. So, you know, mm-hmm. given everything that you're doing out there, do you have a seat at the table when it comes to broader conversations in Oregon about, quote unquote, gun control, gun safety? Can you talk a little bit about what your 2019 was like?
I definitely have a seat at the table.
Good.
When it comes through, obviously, this determination and experience. You know, right now, it started last December. I wrote a Senate bill in a coffee shop on an iPad, and I worked the system the way that it was designed. And we started out as an LC, a legislative concept, and, you know, we got traction, and we had bipartisan support, and we worked it all the way to a public hearing. And so it was a tremendous honor to be able to work and do what I do on behalf of the kids of Oregon. And so we had a great run. We learned a lot, and we definitely opened up the nation's eyes to the sheer possibility of education in public schools.
So you,
and especially here in Oregon.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw you testified at a number of hearings. Can you just kind of a broad outline of what the bill was, what it looked like? I mean, I know it didn't make it all the way through, but, you know, what was the verbiage without going into too much detail?
Senate Bill 801 would mm-hmm. authorize firearm safety and education, which would authorize our program to be taught in public schools by either, you know, a responsible party, which could have been a teacher mm-hmm. or law enforcement. And so basically what that would have done is strictly accident prevention. It doesn't political. It doesn't promote guns, or it doesn't discourage gun use. It promotes safety. Mm-hmm. And it's similar to like what I said earlier when we were talking about, you know, water safety or fire safety or stranger danger. It's kind of the same principle that goes along with all of those that we already teach in public schools. But if we look statistically, you know, firearms are definitely more dangerous when it comes to, and we're not having a conversation. And so our goal with Senate Bill 801 was to just start that dialogue and kind of gauge the public's, you know, comfort for education in our public schools. And it was a hit, you know, and so we're hoping to go back either, I'm not sure if we're going to do it in the short session next year, but we'll definitely be back in 2 years. and we'll go back again and try all over again.
How were you received in, you know, the Marble House? You know, talking to legislators. Obviously it's a partisan house, and so, you know, any yeah. anecdotes, any stories you can share with us about how certain conversations went, good, bad, or indifferent? If you're comfortable.
I had some very interesting conversation. I met a lot of good friends.
Uh-huh.
Because it was bipartisan.
Yeah.
I wasn't there to either push an agenda, mm-hmm. or, you know, obviously I was pushing a safety agenda,
mm-hmm.
but I was able to have very, you know, effective conversations with both sides of the aisle. And I opened some eyes and had a lot of people that actually on both sides of the aisle that were pulling for me. And so obviously, you know, it was a disappointing that it died in committee. But I think it showed that, you know, that our legislature could, you know, if we could come together, we could actually get something done that would do something from day one to protect our children.
Do you think it died in committee because there were so many other high profile issues that kind of sucked the oxygen out of the air?
It did, for sure. And,
yeah.
and that's the thing, is we had about 37 anti-gun bills in
yeah.
the legislature,
yeah.
and then there was ours. And
wow.
so there was only two bills that got a public hearing, and it was ours. And it was actually written by somebody that's an expert on the subject matter. Okay, I'm the state's foremost expert when it comes to kids' firearm safety. And, you know, unfortunately, all the other bills are written by somebody that has no experience
yeah.
with firearms. So that's what makes, you know, what we did truly spectacular, because we're able to have somebody that knows a lot about guns actually write something that could have really made a difference in the state of Oregon.
That's got to carry a lot of weight and have a lot of gravitas when you're speaking, because I know you're right. You see a lot of these bills, whether it's guns or other issues, where you've got the people that are crafting the legislation that really they're not subject matter experts, or they have an agenda that they've staked a flag on one side of
yep.
the issue or not. And I think that's what makes
yep.
yours unique, that you're really coming at it from a safety and education perspective.
Yeah, and it comes down to, with, you know, 16,000 kids have been through our program with
yeah.
zero accidents. Okay, so that being said, is we actually have our own data that separates us from the CDC. So our data is pure, and so we're not being influenced by either Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C., or California. And those are all states and cities that have high rates of restriction.
Yeah.
And so that being said, I'm able to present that to the legislature, say, here, I have this data that it is not skewed, it's pure, like, let's have a conversation. And it's all about, you know, keeping that conversation going and being able to actually do something meaningful that is common sense and will actually save lives from day one.
I really want to see you come back again with this. I mean, in conversations that I've had with people on both sides of the aisle, the safety and the education aspect seems to get pushed down. And especially mm-hmm. it does when we have a high-profile, tragic, terrible shooting like we've had the past couple, and it always comes back up, and I hear common sense gun control, I hear, you know, there's certain buzzwords out there, but I think when you presented this to the legislature last time, to me that looked like a solid step in the right direction to try to, you know, I don't think we can ever really stop these kind of things, but to mitigate the damage.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's our goal is you know, for us to truly, and what we can do as an organization, we can prove, and I can prove from a shadow of a doubt, that gun control and gun restriction will lead to a higher mortality in our children.
Mm-hmm.
I can look at Chicago. I can look at California. I can look at what's happening now in Washington. You're going to see an uptick in child death because of higher rates of restriction. It's common fact. I'm not sure how well it's going to be studied, because people don't want to have this conversation.
I know.
But I'm going to keep going through with what we're doing in our message and keep it on point and about safety, and we'll be able to document everything from there going forward.
So you mentioned that you're getting some national attention as well, and you're looking at expanding. What does expanding for Child Safe Foundation look like within Oregon and then nationally?
So currently I'm in talks with, I can't talk too much about
sure.
some major,
yeah.
major retailers that will help with the infrastructure and be able to, you know, put our program in their stores all over the country. I also have about 100 instructors all over the country that are ready to go.
Wow.
As soon as I have the legal green light, they will have access to our curriculum, and they'll be able to teach our curriculum everywhere in the country. And so the goal is, obviously we have 16,000 here in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
but I want to reach, you know, 500,000 or 1 million all over the country. And that's the goal. And having good volunteers and good staff, That's what's going to help us truly make a difference and kind of prove that, you know, education will do more than restriction or regulation.
So true. So what does a volunteer, you know, somebody who's listening to this broadcast, likes what they're hearing, wants to get involved, wants to volunteer, what are you looking for in a volunteer?
Well, I'm looking for somebody that's going to obviously know something about firearms, also, you know, be able to interact with the kids on the way that I interact. You know, I'm like a big kid myself. I have so much fun, you know, working with the kids.
Yeah.
And you can see that from our social media.
Yes, definitely.
And so that's, you know, those are my key things that I'm looking for in a volunteer to kind of help, you know, keep that message going forward into their areas and their locations and their kids.
So before we close out with you, Derek, give us your website so that people can go learn more about Derek LeBlanc and the Kids Safe Foundation. What's that website?
Okay, you can find us on our website, kidssafefoundation.org. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under Kids Safe Foundation as well.
Okay, we'll link up in show notes on this for the podcast as well for people to do that. Derek, I want to thank you very much for the work you do. I think it's so important. Like I said, I'm a supporter, a fan. I love what you're doing. I want to see it grow. Again, Derek LeBlanc from the Kids Safe Foundation. Thanks so much for taking the time, Derek. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right. Well, that I would encourage people, if you're interested in this, to really go learn more. I think this is one of the keys to, it needs to be broader in the conversation. We get caught up on sort of tribalism and sides on this thing, and I think this is a really good answer. So
I thought that there was something like this already, but I'm glad that he's bringing this to the table, because I learned it as a young kid. Gun safety.
Yeah.
We started with the baby gun and worked up to the hunting.
Right.
And always respect.
Always respect it. It's a tool.
Always.
It's
and
a
yeah.
tool.
And, yeah. And kids nowadays, like you said, their reality is shaped by some of the video games.
Right.
And I didn't have that when I was younger.
Yeah, no.
Right?
Why?
So,
Pong.
Yeah, right?
Pong.
I started with Pong. So
we're dating ourselves, Dave.
Totally. So, yes, kids need to be taught the safety and what is real and what is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes along with the safety of, you know, like you said, bike helmets,
learning how to swim,
swimming, stranger danger, crossing the streets, all of that stuff. You can't just step into the street or chase after a ball that goes into the street because cars don't necessarily see you.
Actions have consequences.
That's right.
And I like that he ties classroom with practical as well, because
I think
we were talking off air about I was a Cub Scout mom and BB gun day was the highlight of camp knee deep.
Right.
Everybody, all the kids were like, it's BB gun day. And it was the best day.
And so, you had fun.
We did. We did.
All right.
We're going to take another quick break. When you are listening to Newsmakers Wednesdays with Denise on 1430 KYKN, Salem is listening.
Now back to Len Benton Tractor's Newsmakers Wednesdays with Denise Quinn and Dave Bourne, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions in the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers is proudly brought to you by Color Tile of Salem.
Oh, I need to be visiting Color Tile of Salem. Home improvement projects.
Yeah, I'm hoping for a new home. So I don't have to worry about that.
Oh, see, I'm remodeling my old 100-year-old home, slowly but surely. That's a problem.
Then you need to see them.
I need to see them. I actually talked to them about some things. So
good.
I'm in the need of some new tile.
That's always good for a new or older home, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Coat of paint, new floor, new rug.
I'm living it right now. Coat of paint, new floor, new rugs. It's like a brand new house.
It makes a brand new house.
It does. Oh my gosh. So when we started the show, we talked about last week's show, where we had Senators Bart Shugar and Thatcher on. And that we talked about, you know, what happened, what it was like to be inside the Capitol during, you know, towards the end of the session. And I thought there was some really good insights from them that, you know, sort of personal, what it was like personally for them, because you don't typically hear that side of things. And recently, Senator Bill Hansel, I think it was actually yesterday, if I'm looking at my calendar, put out an op-ed that kind of walks through what his process was like, what it felt like, kind of the pushback, the feedback, the good, the bad, the ugly that he's been getting. And I thought I wanted to share that with our listeners because I don't know, you know, how many would have read it. I've been seeing it pop up on social media, but I think it's important to read because it kind of walks you through the timeline of what some of the key moments were during the process. And he was one of the Oregon 11. And so mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and share that.
Okay.
He starts out, he says, much has been written, discussed, opined, and debated about the denying of a quorum for 9 days when the 11 Oregon Senate Republicans made the decision to leave. Senator Hansel, was one of what became known as the, quote, Oregon 11. And as I have tried to do with every decision I've ever made as an elected official, I want to explain why I did what I did. It's also important to explain the events leading up to that decision. He says, while I have read or listened to, especially social media, I have come to the conclusion that I'm either a hero or a zero. There isn't much in between. My purpose here is not to debate the merits and flaws of HB 2020, the cap and trade bill, that precipitated the decision to leave. I personally believe that there were huge problems with HB 2020 as it was written, but that's not the reason I walked. My primary reason for leaving was the refusal of the majority party to refer this bill to the people for a vote. Oregonians deserve to be able to vote on this bill. I believe the costs, the impacts, and the insignificant results of actual carbon reduction needed to be decided by the citizens, not the supermajority of one party. There were two ways cap and trade could have gone to the voters. First, the legislature could have amended the bill to refer it. I believe that such a referral was included in several of the 117 proposed amendments offered to the bill. I know. But all were turned down by the Joint Committee on Carbon Reduction. The second way was for the legislature to remove the infamous, quote, emergency clause, unquote. Without going too far into the weeds, when an emergency clause is attached to a bill, it becomes law upon signature of the governor. It makes it much more difficult for citizens to refer it to the ballot. Technically, it's not impossible for the referral, but much more difficult. In my opinion, that is why the emergency clause was attached to HB 2020. I was hard-pressed to see any reason to justify an emergency. There was none. Without an emergency clause, any bill becomes law 6 months after the governor signs it. In those 6 months, signatures can be gathered and a vote taken prior to the bill becoming law. The referendum process is a check and balance Oregonians have on their legislature.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Oregonians have used it to repeal or adopt legislation over the years. So now he kind of breaks into the timeline here about what happened. So on Tuesday, June 18th, a good friend and a member of the Senate Democratic leadership came to my office and asked me what it would take to keep me from, quote, walking. I replied, remove the emergency clause from HB 2020. Let the people have the opportunity to vote on something this monumental. It needs to be on the ballot. That senator indicated that made sense and that they would try and see what could be done. I believe my friend tried, but to no avail. The Republican caucus was also informed that three of our colleagues across the aisle were no votes, but they were unable to satisfactorily confirm their position. Later, when Senate President Peter Courtney publicly announced that he did not have the votes, it set the stage for our return. Next, on Wednesday, June 19th, two events happened that might have averted the walkout. The first would have been delaying the second reading on HB 2020. The Oregon Constitution requires every bill be read three times before voting on it. The bill had first read by title only and then sent to a committee. If the bill survives the committee process, it comes back to the floor for a second reading, again by title only. And the next day it is read for a third time and a vote is taken. Republican leadership urged the Senate president not to second read HB 2020 in order for negotiations to continue. However, HB 2020 was second read on Wednesday with the emergency clause intact. And it would be third read on the next day, June 20th. That meant the walkout was on for Thursday unless negotiations could hammer out something of a compromise. So he goes on to say, three individuals began meeting on Wednesday at 10 a.m. and for the next 7+ hours came up with some kind of a proposal. Those individuals were Senator Cliff Bentz, Vice Chair of the Carbon Committee Nick Blosser, who is Governor Kate Brown's Chief of Staff, and Representative Karen Power, the co-chair of the Carbon Reduction Committee. Two Democrats and one Republican worked into the early evening. 15 minutes after the proposal was presented to Governor Brown, House Speaker Tina Kotek and Senate President Peter Courtney, a call was made to Senator Bentz informing him that the proposal had been rejected. Had either of those two events produced a different result, we would have stayed. On Wednesday evening, the emergency clause remained in HB 2020. It would be third read on Thursday, and the citizens, for all practical purposes, would be denied the opportunity to consider and debate the merits of the bill in the referendum process. I felt this was wrong, and I joined my fellow Republican senators in leaving and denying a quorum on Thursday. So he finishes with, there you have it, why I decided to leave. If you believe impediments should not have been removed in enabling the good people of Oregon the opportunity to vote on this proposed legislation, then we disagree, and I'll continue to be a zero. But at least you know why I did what I did. This is what I owe to all my constituents, whether I'm a hero or a zero or something in between. And with apologies to Mr. Shakespeare regarding how I answered the question, to leave or not to leave.
Nice.
So that's a great synopsis, wrap-up of kind of the timeline and why he made the decisions he did. I would venture to guess that the other 10 senators probably had similar decision-making metrics that they were using when they made that choice.
I'm sure they all chatted a little bit, too.
I'm sure they did as well. You know, but it sounds like, you know, every effort really was made to try to come to some kind of a compromise to reach a deal. But the bottom line was, remove that emergency clause and we'll stay. And if you don't, then we won't. So here we are.
I never understood why they wanted to put that in.
Wait a minute.
I know why they put it in, to make it harder for all of us to repeal it.
Us, the voters. The bosses.
But, right. And they should only put that clause in there, though, if indeed it is an emergency. And there hasn't been anything like that except for maybe, I don't know, forest fires. Flooding.
Maybe, yeah. I think they learned a lesson from the driver card issue back in 2014 when there wasn't one, and it immediately went into the referendum process. And the voters, every county with the exception of Multnomah County by a very small margin, was a resounding no. We don't want driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. And so now I think it was HB 2015 was signed in. There was an emergency clause on it. Off it goes. It's now on the books.
And we can never repeal it?
You know, that part of the process, I don't see why we couldn't. I'm not sure. I'm not a super expert on this stuff about what the process would be to do that. Of course, the people always have, you know, avenues to do that. I'd be curious to see. It felt like whack-a-mole in the 19th session. If you saw, you had put one down over here and another one sticks up its head over there.
Right.
And you're constantly, and I don't know, you know, that's part of the big divine plan, the big plan that, you know, to tire everybody out. You just kind of get tired after a while when you're on this. The Oregon Citizens Lobby is watching bills all the time over there, and there's thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of legislation that go through every session. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the short session, because I know we talked about with the senators, it really is for administrative purposes, balance the budget, cross some I's, clean up some language in a bill. It's not meant for ramming things like HB 2020 through in a very short, truncated session. What do you think they're going to try to do then?
In the short session?
Yeah, do you think it'll be back?
It'll be back, maybe in a different form.
See, and it's interesting talking to Derek, who Derek LeBlanc, our guest earlier, who was talking about his, 801. You know, that couldn't really see the light of day. I'm glad it made it through as far as it did. But that's not something, this huge, behemoth, comprehensive, overarching horda of a bill. It's very specific.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that, I would see, okay, if you're going to bring something back, bring that one back. But something as huge as HB 2020, with 117 amendments and all the agita and angst that went with that, I would hate to see that come back in the short session. I think that would do a disservice to Oregonians again.
Absolutely. And they just passed that $1 billion a year tax, the other one. And then this cap and trade, that's a double whammy on the economy.
Right. And then you've got local jurisdictions. Salem was coming up, you know, there's payroll taxes, there's all kinds of things. And again, it seems to be this sort of trying to usurp the voice of the voters. Granted, that's going to most likely be referred to the voters, the Salem payroll,
Salem issue.
Yes, thank goodness. But it seems to be the sort of general norm, the knee jerk for certain individuals and certain members of a certain party, not saying who, to sort of usurp that and to shove the voters aside. And, you know, we know better. We'll take care of this. Well, no. Well,
as you said. Actions have consequences.
So do elections.
Yes, they do.
So do elections. All right, we're going to take a quick break before we come back. You are listening to Wednesdays with Denise on the Newsmakers program on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers, Wednesdays with Denise and Dave, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Now let's go back to the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
and these cool studios of Newsmakers is proudly brought to you by Sylvan Learning Center.
Cool studios, huh?
Cool. That's air conditioned.
I thought you were going with decor, and I'm like, ah. Yeah.
We need to really work on that.
Maybe a little bit.
All right. We were talking about gun safety education with Derek earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dwayne is on the phone and wants to talk about gun control legislation, which we were also talking about.
We were.
Welcome, Dwayne.
Hey, Dwayne.
Hi. I'm assuming, as is probably a reasonable assumption, that most of the concern right now is over these mass killings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to target semi-automatic firearms and high-capacity magazines as being responsible for this. There's a problem with that. Those have been available since the 1920s and 1930s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And up until 1968, they were available through the mail to anyone of any age with no background check. Now, what that tells you is that it's not a firearms issue,
mm-hmm.
because any increase in availability of firearms cannot cause something. You can kind of see the logic there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, something, however, is influencing the shooters or whatever else you want to blame other than the physical object, and that type of problem can be solved by epidemiological methods. If you take all of the possible causes that people are suggesting and look at the rise in availability of, I don't know, pick anything, SSRI drugs, mm-hmm. Anything anybody wants to suggest. I mean, even anything that, you know, if you want to suggest that it's capitalism, you can go ahead and suggest that. And the point is that there are well-established methods for determining correlation between increases in any number of factors and the combination of those factors. And you can trace, you can track that with the rise of these mass killings. And I guarantee you that if a study like that is done properly, it will determine at least what the causal factors are.
So,
and the worst part about legislation that just attacks the obvious,
mm-hmm.
You know, something obvious, is that it's almost guaranteed to fail.
Right.
Because it doesn't use proper methods of determining real causes.
I think you're onto something here, Dwayne, and I agree with a lot of your assessments. We don't ever seem to get to that level of the conversation because we can't get past the part of the big scary gun.
I believe this, I'm not sure, but I believe this is what Trey Gowdy was talking about when he said that we must apply scientific methods to this or we'll never solve it.
Right.
And I really think, you know, I don't think this needs to happen at the state level, the analysis, that is. I would actually, if I were able to determine what to do, I would probably put Dr. Carson in charge of it because he's the only one I see up there that has enough medical education to understand epidemiology and the methodology that's necessary and to maintain, you know, rigorous scientific objectivity.
I would love that to have that conversation, but like I said, we never seem to be able to get to it, especially in a media that tends to focus so much on the object, and we can never get to the root cause or even have a conversation because we don't even really agree on what the problem is.
Well, the thing is, I don't know this, you know, I have for sure, but I suspect that there are people that don't want the answer.
Yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I suspect you're right.
And I don't think the American people, if they're educated to the facts here, they'll tolerate being railroaded like that by lead. And the worst part of it is that failure, enacting any sort of extensive legislation that fails,
mm-hmm.
is worse than waiting to enact legislation that you know at least has a good chance of success.
I agree with you. What do you think of, you know, like what Derek was talking about earlier in the show, that the legislation 801 that he was doing? I mean, do you see that as a good thing, kind of moving the ball down a little bit down the field towards the right conversation?
So you mean firearms education?
Yeah, for kids, yeah.
I do think so. Probably not for the, I mean, I've been a longtime advocate of firearms training in the school,
mm-hmm.
but not for the reasons everyone thinks. One of the problems that we have is that the media, and particularly the Hollywood types, mm-hmm. they glorify guns with all of this, as Wayne LaPierre calls it, gratuitous violence,
mm-hmm.
that just And, you know, the kids look at this and they get a big thrill out of it. Now, if you train people what firearms really are, it will demystify them to the firearms, that is. It will remove the mystique that Hollywood has created around them to the point where you'll at least realize. I mean, some people don't understand, you know, what a firearm will do to a human body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you see what I'm saying?
I do.
They don't get it. They think it's a game. It's a psychological thing. And you know, so the more familiar, anybody who's trained their kids, you know, about firearms will tell you that the kids that are really trained in what those things will do and know how to shoot them and are maybe competitive or target shooters, mm-hmm. they don't have these, you know, they don't tend to get these random impulses to go shoot somebody because they know what that means. Somebody that doesn't even know how a firearm operates is much more likely to, you know, to yield to that kind of homicidal impulse.
Yeah, it's such a big issue, and you bring up really, really good points, and I'm really glad you called in, Dwayne, because you do bring up good points, and we never really seem to get our elected officials and media, we never can get past the surface level of yelling and screaming about each other about big, scary guns and get to the meat of it, because we're never going to solve the problem if we can't get there.
Well, our chances of solving it are very slim if we don't determine the root cause of these things to start with. And it's clearly not our availability of firearms.
Right.
That's the thing. You can see that from the correlation or lack thereof of availability throughout the last 70 years or so and the time during which these mass killings have started.
So it's not the guns that have changed, it's people.
It has to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not an opinion. That's an inescapable
mm-hmm.
conclusion.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dwayne, so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling, Dwayne. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
That was a great call.
It was a great
call.
He's right.
Every point he made. I mean, you know, this is a much broader, deeper conversation that we don't ever seem to get to because you've got one side screaming and, you know, and everyone's trying to blame everybody else. And if we can take the ego, take all of that and take the emotion out. First of all, you never make legislative decisions when you're emotionally distraught and upset.
Absolutely.
And that always seems to be the case. The old, we must do something now. Take a breath. We need to be thoughtful about these things. They impact lives on every level.
Yeah. And bring in people like Derek. Who are instructing the younger ones about the gun safety.
Exactly. And it hand in glove. It's comprehensive. It's got to be, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to this.
Yeah.
And granted, we may never solve it. But
and psychologists mm-hmm. and all that stuff.
He talked about SSRIs. I mean, you've got medicated people. There's so many factors to look at the whys of why this is happening.
Absolutely.
But the bottom line is it's not the guns that have changed. It's us.
Yeah. And you look at other countries, too, where they have no guns. Like Europe, some parts of Europe doesn't.
They have guns in Europe.
But they don't allow it like in Paris or something like that.
There were lots
that.
Of guns in Paris when I was there. They were all strapped on soldiers'
right. But they have an uptick in knife attacks.
Right, exactly. People who
they'll find a weapon to use.
If you have a murderous heart, you will find a way to commit murder.
And it's pretty sad.
It is. It really is.
Like Washington, D.C., too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very strict gun laws there, and they have the highest murder rate from guns.
It's a heart issue. It's a human issue.
It is.
Yeah. And
we're just scratching the surface.
We are. And, you know, and I think a lot of it has to do with control, and there's other motivations behind keeping this conversation going.
All right. In the last 20 seconds.
I think great show today. Derek was fantastic. I think I would encourage everyone to go look up information on Kids Safe Foundation. It's a worthy effort. If you're interested in helping him out, becoming a volunteer, definitely go look that up.
Definitely.
I want to thank him. And then again, Dwayne, for calling in. Great information. Good insights.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for Wednesdays with Denise on Newsmakers. We'll see you tomorrow.
This has been Len Benton Tractor's Newsmakers, Wednesdays with Denise Quinn and Dave Bourne. Presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Live local talk that matters to you from the Capital Auto Group studios, exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.